right, it's 5 o'clock. Let's roll. Nice. Carlin, do you have anything before Mr. Sorrell starts this?
I do not. Just turn it over to Mr. Sorrell.
I'm Dave Sorrell, Director of Utilities. With me tonight, Steve Hunt. He's the Assistant Director for Solid Waste. And Nick Paul, Recovery Superintendent. And Kate Vasquez.
Vasquez is good.
Vasquez. All right, that's close. You. And she's up with our consultant, RRT. So, as many of you are aware, our MRF is getting kind of old. A lot of the equipment's outdated and worn out. It's getting close to capacity, and so we thought it would be a good idea to have somebody do an evaluation of our existing facility, make recommendations of improvements. Are there things we're doing we shouldn't do? Are there things we should be doing we're not doing? Should we change our collection methods, et cetera, et cetera? And Kate's here to just give you an update on where we're at in the process.
Thank you.
Welcome, Kate.
Thank you. It's good to see several of you again. Thank you for the introduction, and I'm with RRT Design and Construction. We are a consulting firm, an engineering firm that specializes in solid waste. I am the non-engineer at the engineering firm, director of our planning and advisory services, and as David said, this is an update on a project we've been working on. We initialized last August near the end of the month. We kicked off on America Recycles Day, November 15th, and the project is proceeding along, and we have some major updates since I last got to speak with several of you and some new faces here. So I didn't want to assume that everyone at the dais knew what the project was. As David said, we've been looking at all the programs from the point of discard up into and through the MRF. And that one doesn't work, so I'll use this one. So we have been doing a lot of activity on the project over the last close to a year. I'm going to go through the findings and results of a lot of that activity, and then you see a few are in italics here. Those are the ones that are still ongoing or they're pending. We've done a lot of data collection. That is pretty much complete. So in the next few slides, I'm going to go through all the activities of the project and what they've produced. So as I said, the data collection is largely complete. We started off with a MRF evaluation and a MRF contamination study. A MRF evaluation is of the condition of the equipment and how it's performing, how much life it might have left, and when. And there'll be a little bit more work on it to determine what level of effort might be involved to keep it going. In the case of this MRF, because it is at end of life and it is also at capacity, that write-up will be limited, but that was the finding of the MRF evaluation. The MRF contamination study was conducted at a separate time, and that was evaluating the performance of the MRF, what it's producing, and how well it is working. So one looked at the equipment, the latter looked at the materials. They go hand in hand, and they had similar findings. The contamination study, like I said, was looking at the material, and it also was seeing if it seconded what the MRF evaluation found. The results are that the material that the MRF is producing is of high quality, but it is failing to capture a lot of the recyclable material that people send to it, and that's just a function of its condition. So looking at some of the findings about the material that's going to and through the MRF, about half the plastics were our number one PET bottles. That's our best value plastic. And very little of it was the 3 through 7s, which we accept, but they are of very low value. In this setting, when we're looking at the container line, which anyone who's not aware, we have a dual stream MRF, so bottles and cans go on one line, paper and cardboard go on another. Paper is not counted as a correct recyclable on the container line because it was put in the wrong place. That is called an outthrow. Contamination is something that people put in there that they weren't supposed to, like a plastic bucket. It's not that it's not necessarily recyclable, it's not recyclable in our program. And then last we have residue. That's straight up trash that should have never been in there even close to begin with. So you can see that we have a good rate of the plastics and other material that we're supposed to have. And just as you can, I wanted to note here, that's composition, not a recycling rate or anything like that. So like 30% of the material at the MRF is plastics, and it sums to of 100. finds is grit, teeny tiny pieces that can't be captured, etc.
Can I ask?
Yes. Absolutely.
What is film plastic?
Like bags. Mm-hmm. Bags and bags is the biggest one, yeah. And it's a high. There's a big percentage there because that includes our blue bags. But also, if someone had put another kind of bag in there, a lot of times people really want to recycle plastic bags, and they put them in their recycling bin. But yes, that's a great question. Yeah, and you'll see that on the other compositions as well. So then, looking at the paper side, 95% of the samples were correct recycling things, material that we take in the paper program. And then we had a very tiny amount of outthrows. Remember, that was something that ended up in the wrong place, so that would have been bottles and cans. Very low rate of contamination. 4.7% is an exceptionally low rate of contamination. And then very, very little residue, which includes the bags that materials in themselves. I wanted to note that these levels of very low contamination might be a little misleading to try and connect them to behavior. Because the material on the paper line at the MRF has been pre-screened unofficially in two different ways. One is that collection workers at the curb would reject and tag improperly prepared paper bins. And so in that way, one, they're preventing contamination coming to the MRF. And then also when the workers at the MRF are loading the paper line with its infeed, if they see a bag of something, they pull it out. So by the time the paper goes into the initial screens and to the pickers, it's been pre-screened, and that isn't captured when we were sampling the result in the bunkers. However, it is consistent with observations that our colleague made that it's still, what's going there is in pretty good shape. Of the contamination, mostly it was trash, then followed by paper that we're not currently marketing, such as envelopes with windows. Envelopes with windows are recyclable in mixed waste paper programs, but right now, the way the paper is being sold, it's considered unacceptable by the buyer. Any questions about that? Okay, great. So some other findings from the MRF contamination study. The extremely high quality supports the from the residential curbside material. Supports the idea that a lot of the material that's coming to the MRF that shouldn't be is coming from the drop-off centers or from the commercial cans downtown, which we know have issues with contamination from everything from the people putting it in to passersby. And we also just noted that a lot of quality material is just not getting captured and put into the bales, and it's because of the condition of the equipment at the MRF. I'm next going to comment and share with you about a waste composition study. So this is now doing a similar review and looking at the composition of the material that's dumped at the landfill, that's sent for disposal by people, so trash. This is a specialized subcontractor that RRT has used several times. They have a robust software program. They have an excellent protocol. It's the bulk of the work they do, and they're kind of a gold standard in the industry. This was designed to figure out what proportion of what is getting sent as trash could have been diverted from the landfill, whether it's to a recycling program or to some other better management option than disposal in our landfill. It uses a scientific sampling method, and it uses complex statistical analysis that is the reason we hire a sub to use that to project with a high level of confidence that the samples reflect the overall waste stream. The finding, big finding, high level finding, was that about 21% of all the trash was actually recyclables, and that over 35% of it could have been diverted from the landfill in some other way. So we will dive in and look. Now, I admit that is a kind of a hard graphic to see on a screen. It will be, you'll see it in a report, but what I wanted to point out to you is that the way that the sample works. So we start out by identifying 46 material types. These are usually they're consistent from one study to another, but then we customize them for what we are trying to learn in this. So for example, in another setting, we might want to know what size is available too, because of what maybe we were trying to procure a technology. In this case, we were trying to see what could have been recycled or diverted. So that is why we identified the categories that we did. We broke them into six qualities as far as programs. So everything that's got dark blue is a program in our recycling program, is a material in our recycling program. Anything with Kelly Green by it is other city programs besides curbside, and it's yard waste and the household hazardous waste program. So material that could have gone to those programs, but it did not for whatever reason. The royal blue are materials that are divertible in existing, I'm going to call them community programs. So for example, best example is donating textiles to a charity. And then the orange color is, these are materials that there is technology available to recycle them, but not in this marketplace at this time. Yellow are labeled processable organics, but it is essentially food waste. And then the red is materials that they're actually garbage. You know, there's really not a way to recover them at this point in time. Sanitary products, very tiny pieces of things, or something that is cross-contaminated with oil or food or something like that. So the sorters processed 44 samples. Each one is about 200 pounds. And they broke it out into about one-third residential and two-thirds of them from the commercial sector. They have a methodology for estimating how many they do of each sector that's based on real data. However, that is consistent with most U.S. cities, where about one-third of the waste is residential and two-thirds is commercial. So we literally stand at the table and we pick through every bit of the sample, break open bags, sort it out by what it is into buckets, then they weigh out the buckets and use that to calculate the percentages. So let's look at the lost recyclables in our waste. Now, from all sources, on average, it was about 21%, as I said. However, you can see that the commercial generators are wasting far more recyclables than the residential generators. Residential generators, about 15% of their waste stream was recyclables or something that could have been recycled, and commercial was more like a quarter. So again, I would consider that a pretty good effort by residents. The number one lost recyclable, this is the top 10 list of materials in the waste that could have been recycled, was cardboard. And it's, again, that is mostly coming from commercial sector. Everything else on there as far as our top 10, looking down that list, remainder, composite paper, those are not recyclable things unless they're treated properly. So they've already been contaminated once they go into the garbage. Looking at what other kinds of materials could have been recovered, not necessarily our recyclables like our bottles and cans and paper, I won't read you that list. But you can see that all sources, it's about 20% food waste, 16% other recoverables. But in residential, it is they're pretty close, but residential is edging a little bit towards more the other recoverables. Well, that's partly for a variety of reasons. Businesses don't tend to have yard waste. Businesses inherently can't have household hazardous waste because it's household hazardous waste. So. But there, you see there on the left a list of examples. And when we talk about how it could have been diverted, for example, food waste, it could have been composted on site. It might have been sent to a private vendor, put down a garbage disposal, or just maybe avoided in the first place. Any questions about the composition study before I move on? A sneak a sip of water. So next is the curbside collection study. And this was designed to get an idea of a participation rate. A participation rate gives you an idea of what proportion of the population participates in the recycling program. It is slightly different than a set-out rate, which we use for planning routes, because that's an idea of, on any given collection day, how many set-outs are there. Because on any given collection day, there may be a house that house 123 Maple Street, they participate, but they didn't set anything out today. We planned 2 2-week periods where my colleague rode along, and the first 2 weeks went well, and then the second 2 weeks coincided with having to suspend service. So we have decided not to pursue with the participation rate study. We're just going to take that data at face value, and it's more like a set out rate, and not use it for projecting any kind of other rate in the way that we had planned. It's not without value, but it is just going to be at face value. It kind of corresponds, because in that first 2 weeks, our finding was that the set outs were smaller and fewer per instance than we would have expected in a biweekly program. Usually when you have a biweekly program, the set outs are large, the people who are participating, and you have a higher participation, you have a higher set out rate because it's only every 2 weeks. So people don't tend to skip. So we looked at that data in close comparison to some of the stakeholder information I'm going to discuss in a moment, and it kind of went along and seconded what we heard people saying. But the set out sizes were what we would have expected to see in a weekly, and then so we started learning why. And the other takeaway from this is because there are fewer and smaller than we would expect, any kind of service program change at the curb is going to have huge changes in both available information about set out and participation that we know colloquially from the present. So stakeholder engagement. We've been very active coming here to Columbia, meeting with people. This was a really important part of the project. It was very clear right from the reading of the RFP that that was going to be really important. We had an open house in March. We had meetings with city council members. We had another open house in May, and then we have this session today. And there was also a Be Heard survey that coincided with the first open house. And the Be Heard survey was, just going to ask high-level questions to understand how people use the program. And we found that there are a lot of people who are not, they think the program is pretty easy to use. A lot of people are interested in getting weekly collection back. When we asked about carts for recycling, they were very divided, not really a clear consensus. And I have a note here. There were several comments that indicated some misinformation about the MRF. People would say, well, because as I know, and then they would state something that's mistaken. And so that's going to be a really important part of an information and education program, because even people who are vested in the program have some misconceptions about it. So that will be important. A lack of confidence in a recycling program can be a major obstacle to need to overcome to get people back engaged.
Can you give an example or two of some of the misinformation that people had or shared?
The big one was, I know most of the plastic isn't getting recycled, but I put it in there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that? Because I know. I know it's not recyclable. There have been several well-publicized articles in mainstream media opining about recycling. The single biggest issue with that is this is an enormous country with very diverse markets and what's accepted and what's taken. Even when you look up in our industry information about price, the country is divided into 5 or 6 regions because it's not the same in Southern California as it is in the Northeast region. What can be diverted? What can be recycled? What do you get for it? What happens to it? So you can't make broad brush statements like, well, I know most of the plastic isn't getting recycled. Well, there are some towns where they're taking all the plastics, but yeah, a lot of it is getting used as a fuel or some other thing because they can't market it. But that's not a valid description here for Columbia.
How is the information disseminated as to what's picked up, what's sold, what revenue is generated? Maybe not in what you did, but to get that information out to maybe combat that, oh, we're picking the plastics up, but we're not doing anything with it.
I mean, it's, I think most of the current education program is more instructions for use, as opposed to something like a campaign or messages of values. It's more, your day is Tuesday, and this is how you set it out.
Okay, so like a little column in the newsletter that comes with our monthly utility statements.
There's information on the website that says what products we do process,
right,
and which we don't.
Right, I know that.
That's available, but as far as revenues generated or volumes, that we have that information, but we've never publicized it.
And this may be indicative of needing to pursue something.
And that may,
Say that. Yeah, I get it. But I mean, even with what we've got, you know, the word is not getting out that, you know, we're picking it up. Yes, we're processing it. We're not just surreptitiously, you know, diverting it to the trash. Like you said, there have been instances, but not here. And so, again, let's educate, you know, work to educate. I'm thinking, again, just a little corner in the week, the monthly newsletter, and say, you know, recycles picked up, plastics, paper, and revenue generated.
I have seen that before, where they'll say, like, that last quarter we collected this much and we recycled this much, and great job, you guys had a 15% contamination rate, you know, that kind of thing. So I can make sure we provide some examples like that in the report.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions about the data gathering? Okay, great. So, based on everything that we learned, combined with our knowledge base of recycling programs and also research of benchmarking and examples from around the country, we've discussed with staff some initial recommendations. They gave us feedback on those different ideas, and we've started writing up the possibilities. So I thought you guys would maybe like to see what some of the potential is that we're looking at. So we're going to look at this as ways to increase diversion through the different programs. Remember I talked about there were city programs, and then there were community programs, and then there were possible new programs, things that exist. We're not reinventing the wheel. We're just bringing the wheel here. And so we'll kind of frame it that way. And I'll start with new materials. So these are items or materials that there's not a current program, but they are, it exists. It's existing known technology. We have some examples here. We have expanded polystyrene at the top left, better known by its brand name of Styrofoam. Bulky plastics, like toys, buckets, laundry baskets. I've got a picture of a pallet there, but that would also include any clean wood, or it's also called white wood, so like lumber cutoffs and things like that. Carpet and padding, and then mattresses. The numbers that you see there were the results from the composition study. That's what's projected goes into the landfill of that kind of material every year.
For us?
Yes. And there is a to be determined on mattresses, because there weren't any mattresses in the sample, so I don't have a value for it.
This month, also, you could find them.
Think of the volume, 825 tons of styrofoam.
Yeah.
Think of the volume.
Like the mattresses that we collect is a special pickup, so we could get the number of those we've collected in the lab since we started that program.
But if we could, like you said, if you could recycle styrofoam, because God knows I've put lawn furniture together, and just, you know, I've got three big plastic trash bags of styrofoam alone.
So expanded polystyrene, it can be recycled easily with a machine called a densifier. I was called and talked to the director of the Charlotte, North Carolina recycling program, who is a former colleague, and there's a machine that's very simple to run. It costs as little as $50,000, which is a great kind of grant project to look for some grant money. It's a nice amount. That's what they did. So it's easy to run, and it makes it into a densified product that can then be marketed. There's a lot of potential in bulky plastics. They have a stable, if not super high value, as a commodity. They are priced as a commodity in the industry. But also people tend to be very interested in recycling them because they're heavy and big, so they perceive value in it. So it's a good opportunity to get your public engaged in something. The clean wood is almost entirely from the commercial sector. A lot of it is going to be commingled with other construction waste and not as readily available as the numbers there might suggest. But if builders knew that they can bring scrap lumber and pallets and things like that to the landfill and not have to pay the tip fee, maybe some of them would get involved. A lot of old pallets or white wood are ground as pre-processing here in Columbia before going to landfill, or some of it is in the mulch program. Grinding it before putting it in the landfill reduces the initial volume, but also makes the wood more available to the bioreactor. And then there is a lot of market value in used pallets as pallets, if someone brings in some pallets, if they're still functional. Carpet is one of the programs we're digging in to learn more about the operations. As a material, carpet is highly recyclable, but it's very difficult to move around, and it often can come in with vectors, which are not good. And mattresses has similar issues.
When you say vectors, what is that?
Bugs.
Okay, thank you.
Soil. Okay. So what we did here is we looked at what we thought were reasonable ambitions for not next year, but eventually sending less of these materials to the landfill, these select materials. So if 10% of what the currently disposed polystyrene was able to go to a recycling program that we had, would be 80 tons. And similarly, so bulky plastic, if half the bulky plastics, people were willing to put them into a program, we'd be looking at 850 tons. This is avoided disposal, going to something else, not going into your landfill. So potentially 1,300 new tons. Compared to, we currently recycle about 13,000 tons. So that's an additional 10% right there. Next, looking at community programs. So these are materials a person might have diverted if they knew about or wanted to participate in a program, but for whatever reason, they didn't. Most of the activity here by the city would be in making sure people have awareness that they can do that, that there's a program available. And the city and the Solid Waste Community Utility can support these programs by creating awareness. And for most of these materials, there is no need to develop a new program. One recommendation for a quote-unquote new program would be to participate in a nationwide campaign called Call to Recycle in an effort to divert batteries. So just to illustrate what my pictures are here, plastic film, both from the residential and commercial sector, scrap metal, electronic waste, tires, and textiles is the bottom right there. For example, when you donate textiles to the national charities that accept clothing donations, it's okay if it's not wearable. They bale it and sell it as fiber. So it's still getting diverted from landfill, even if it doesn't go into the thrift store or to charitable use. Call to Recycle is a national campaign to get rechargeable batteries diverted from disposal. And batteries are a major problem in the waste stream. They increasingly are causing fires. There's a fire every single day at a solid waste facility in the United States. And they, especially if everyone is out of the building, they don't spend resources combating the fire to put it out. It just burns itself out. So the facility is often completely lost. So it's a real problem. So we looked at, again, some ambitions. If we could get 5% of plastic bags, a lot of the plastic bag weight is actual trash bags. That's why my ambition here is low, because trash bags are just part of life. We don't want people putting loose waste in their cart, so they're just going to be part of the disposal stream no matter what. Diverting industrial plastic would be a major process change, so we again have very modest expectations. Most of the scrap metal that was available is from the commercial sector, so we want to investigate more about that. Why are businesses throwing away money? But many residents are also unaware that they can recycle composite metal items like pots and pans in the city's scrap metal program. And then, like I said, e-waste includes batteries. So that's why I have a big ambition there of 60%, because of their fire problem. And also, pound for pound, they're much more potentially polluting than the other materials. So now we're looking at, again, another possible maybe 2,400 tons. The little bits add up. So last, looking at improving our existing recycling programs, you know, our initial projections are showing us that as much as $2 million in foregone revenue on thrown away commodities is going into the landfill every year. So put another way, pound for pound, more recyclables are thrown away than into the recycling program overall. The commercial sector accounts for most of it, but it's probably largely got to do with the cardboard that's coming out of the commercial sector. So we've got here our program materials, we've got household hazardous waste, which is getting thrown away even though there's a program, we've got yard waste, and we've got available food scraps. We've talked a couple of times here. One of the big items is to develop a vigorous outreach and education campaign for all customers to look at using a different kind of controlled container to make the cardboard program work better in the commercial sector. This is a type of container that has a restricted opening, so you can only feed paper in there. You can't put bags of stuff in there. Same with the community drop-off centers, having restricted opening containers, and then looking at if and when weekly service can resume, that those could be phased out, the main reason being that they attract so much contamination. Looking at expanding the household hazardous waste service schedule, this is a good point for me to note that you have an excellent household hazardous waste program. It has limited availability, though, being able to expand where there's more opportunity for people, or if they're doing something else at the same time, they can have like a one-stop shop, have more availability. Right away, like next week, we're recommending to discontinue plastic bags for yard waste. The instruction is to put them out in plastic bags. We're recommending to change the instruction to put them bundled or in a paper bag, because then it's going to be more available for the bioreactor. Even if it goes to landfill. And then look at a drop-off program for food scraps coinciding with the farmer's market. This is a popular model across the U.S. where you would need a vendor, but it can divert a lot of pounds. So I just did two goals here or ambitions about diverting material from landfill. If half of the current wasted cardboard from the commercial sector would go into the recycling program instead, you can see it's a lot of tons, 3,300. And if half of the residential recyclables that are currently being thrown away ended up in the program, it would be another 2,300 tons. So potentially over 5,000 new tons from our targeted recyclables, up from about 13,000 most years. If you achieve these, this would be consistent overall with a modest and with a typical program that's considered successful. So when we look at improving curbside participation, we're looking at how can we know the issues with the recycling program, their labor, their participation, their method. So we're looking at a method to collect the dual stream material, maintain the dual stream program, wherein there would be a cart and fiber or paper would go in loose, and containers would continue to go in a blue bag program. They would go in the same cart, they would be collected in the same truck, and then they would get separated when they arrived at the MRF, similarly as they do now. This lets us have the benefits of automated collection, while maintaining the quality of dual stream. Co-collection in this way is, there are quite a few cities across the U.S. that do it for recycling and trash, but this idea is to do the two recycling streams together.
Good question.
Yes.
Is single stream not something that we could look at, or is that just too daunting?
Or is it not as good?
The results are not as good. The opinion surveys indicate that at least the people who answered the survey didn't have a problem with doing dual stream.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible that the dual stream is part of why some people aren't participating, but with the added convenience of a cart, instead of always having to find a cardboard box or something to put their paper in, also not having to, we're not recommending that it continue to be specified city bags. It could be any blue bag that they purchase, or I believe there's a grocery store in town that uses blue bags, so you could use that too. But just any, it's got to be blue to go in there. And so without the need to have the city bag, and with the addition of having a cart, so it's obvious where I'm going to put my stuff and I can store it and it's convenient, that you would have increased participation while maintaining the definite superiority of, on the commodity value of dual stream. Any other questions about that idea? Okay. So next up, we're going to talk real briefly, I'm close to the end here, about the technical documents that we're now getting, we're producing. So soon, for the final report, we're going to see waste generation projections for 20 years and some modeling of these increased diversion ambitions that we just reviewed. We're also going to see some quantitative information, additional quantitative information about what those programs can hope to achieve. The output includes a conceptual design for a replacement MRF and also example designs for a convenience center. So examples, real designs, places we've been that we know, but how they are designed. And then not to gloss over it, but cost information for all of those options. And it's just not generated yet, so I don't have it to share today, but all of these will include what it might cost to start it, what it might cost to operate it, and detailed cost information about the MRF. So our next activities is continuing to use the data combined with best practices and look at the potential, the kind of things that we discussed at a high level today. And all of those being written up both qualitatively and quantitatively. And we're starting on the design items, and we'll also be, a thing we haven't really talked about a lot except sort of gave examples of it, was looking at different ways to evaluate the performance of the program, not just a straightforward, overly simplistic recycling rate, but more like reducing disposal or increasing diversion, and some of it targeted for specific materials. So we might say we would really love to capture 75% of aluminum cans, but we really want to capture 90% of steel cans. Looking at different ways of doing it. We're benchmarking some from different parts of the U.S. and North America, and we'll be working more on that in the coming weeks before the project concludes. So I wanted to show you here an example of how that all can come together, and I alluded to it a little bit earlier, telling about some what-ifs. If the collection routes were efficient with either rerouting or automated collection or both, how would that impact the service level? Would we be able to resume recycling collection? And would we be able to resume weekly recycling collection? If we had weekly recycling collection, would we necessarily need the problematic community recycling centers? And especially if we had a convenience center where many materials could be accepted and it was staffed and it was a point of outreach. And so if the neighborhood drop-off centers were closed, how would that affect contamination at the MRF? What might be the positive or negative on that? So that is an example of how all that information interweaves into really looking at decision making, which is your part, but how our recommendations would work together for you to consider your decision making. So over the next about a month and a half of the project, we're going to continue our writing and documenting all of our work, finishing our last reports. Our engineer has started getting the numbers he needs for conceptual designs and cost information. And we'll continue to work closely with staff, present our final report, and then I'll get to come see you one more time to present our final. That concludes my prepared slides. I'm happy to take your questions. Any questions for Pete?
I have two questions or comments.
Okay.
One is if we could get the mattress information that Dave says he's got, certainly as it's July in my neighborhood, the mattresses are blooming. because the kids just don't take them anymore. Mm-hmm. And so it would be nice to know, and I know you had commented that there is some program or some college program for recycling. If we could get that information, that would be helpful because those are just big and bulky and look painfully wasteful. And then the other thing is electronic waste we don't seem to have any way really to recycle electronic waste.
There are some retailers that accept them, some parts for free, some parts for fee. Kicking off an electronics program from scratch for the city isn't one of our recommendations, but we are recommending promoting and accepting batteries. In the call to recycle is an existing protocol. It's freight-based, okay. So you take them and then you ship them to a recycling place. The batteries have a lot of available recyclable content, and it would just be a matter of signing up.
Okay.
If for no other reason to make sure as few batteries are going into your own recycling facility as possible.
They're talking about batteries of any type or specifically like the lithium batteries?
That's a great question. So previous guidance, including when I earlier used to be a public employee, was really focused on rechargeable batteries. However, the newest guidance is that we want to try to get any kind of battery diverted from the disposal or the MRF stream. We want to get it into a battery program. Some cities do that through their household hazardous waste. Some do it through an electronics waste program. I would think adding it on to whatever you're doing at household hazardous waste is for batteries is a good option.
Great. Thank you.
And there are batteries in so many things. Mm-hmm. It's kind of amazing. My children got a balloon sculpture at an event, and it had a teeny tiny light inside that had two teeny tiny button batteries.
Dave, this might be for you too, and I'm wondering, it sounds like if we go to a cart approach to this with dual stream and the carts, that we're really talking about expanding what we're already doing with automated trash collection. So how seamless would that be, or would it be seamless at all? and what would you anticipate the transition to work like?
Once we get the final report, and we come back and then get direction from you. I mean, if we wanted to do that, I think it'd be very similar to what we're going to do with the refuse. But it's another truck order, so everything would have to follow some number of months behind. But I think it would be basically the same type of transition we're going to go through in the next 7 months.
And the second cart for the household.
And then there it becomes... Do we continue to make that a voluntary program that you only get a card if you want to participate, or do we, you have to participate, you get a card whether you're going to do it or not? Do we make it a, you've heard a lot about reducing bills when we've been suspended, do we make it a separate charge on the bill? There's a lot of different things we could look at there. I do have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh. So we, I don't remember, what was it, a year ago or so, we looked at possibly adding another drop-off site up off of Oakland Gravel Road in Vandiver on some city-owned property, and we had IP meetings for that, and everything we heard was, we don't want it anywhere near here. And so we brought a report back to council and said we're recommending we just take this out of our project. And I've been asked to look back into that. So we can schedule IP meetings for that, but you know, based on what I'm hearing here, where the recommendation might be that if we come back with automated weekly collections, that we look at phasing those out. Do I need to move forward on that at this point, or do I need to hold off for a little bit?
Mr. Lovelady, I defer to you for that piece because that was something you brought up.
We can do it either way, but I kind of, if ultimately it comes out to recommend to start phasing that out, then do we want to be expanding at the same time?
I think I would be concerned about the folks in the interim. You know, how long would it actually take to procure the carts and things that we would need to implement a program?
Or to get the staff.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's where we're at right now. If we had five more staff or a few that are unavailable for work right now become available, we can start
the every other week back up.
Yeah.
And what's it take? How many? I don't remember off the top of my head for weekly.
Yeah,
that's
10 to 14.
10 to 14. Above what we're at now to do weekly again with our current method.
Staff.
Yes.
I think another consideration for me on your question is, if we go through with it in the interim, is there, are we looking at any type of loss revenue, or, you know, you know what I'm getting at? Like, are we losing anything more than we would be spending otherwise in terms of?
If by not having the drop-offs?
Right. Between having it and not having it.
I don't know that there would be any lost revenue. We'd have to actually sit down and put paper and pencil on that. I mean, depending on what the markets are, a lot of times the revenue doesn't even pay for MRF operations. It ends up getting covered by our monthly fees to residents. But when the markets are up, there's been times when the material we sold more than pays for MRF operations. So by the time you take collections out of there and everything, I don't have a good feel.
I would want to have the discussion about, do we want to completely do away with the central collection sites or not? Because even back when we had weekly pickups, I still found those useful if I got something large, rather than trying to cut the cardboard down to whatever would fit either in a can or whatever. It was, okay, yes, I'll cut it down to where I can fold it flat, but I'm taking it to the drop-off site.
Well, she had recommended potentially, if I'm interpreting what you said or remembering, but shutting everything down, but having one central one that was potentially staffed.
That, yeah, that would be an option, yes.
And if you would, go ahead and explain more detail of what that convenience center, what that actually is. I mean, convenience center, what's that mean? There's a lot more to it than a drop-off site.
That's correct. So a lot of those materials we looked at, maybe you want to start taking mattresses. Maybe you want to start being more robust about the scrap metal program. Start taking bulky plastics. We wouldn't want bulky plastics at the curb, for example. That needs to be something where somebody's like, okay, my kids outgrew the slide. We're done with the plastics, you know, Fisher-Price slide or whatever it is, and then I'm going to go take it, and I'm going to grab that bucket of paint. And it would be, they could bring more than one material to this place called the convenience center. It's staffed. It is safe and easy to use, and it takes multiple materials all at one place, not just bottles and cans and cardboard and paper and things like that. There are a lot of designs of this. With different ways to keep, for example, to keep people traffic away from the truck traffic, to make it easy to understand, easy to insert. You're not trying to like shove something through, you know, a place like this. Also, keeps people from trying to scavenge in the containers by design. And so we'll be sharing some of those. I mean, I could talk about them more, but like there's one at a facility we designed in Minnesota. It's all undercover. They have a similar climate to you, with lots of cold and lots of snow, and so it's all undercover. And the vehicles enter up a grade, almost on like a raised pier of concrete, not like a boat pier. And they discard into different containers, which are serviced at a lower elevation by the trucks. So the trucks are not near the people. It's an open top, so you just have to toss your stuff in there. And there's safety barriers, safety guards. This is a place, for example, there's usually a rule, no children out of a vehicle. And then they just exit out. You also have in that design, we have loading docks where there are tractor trailers all the time for things that accumulate more slowly and also aren't putrescible or drawing bare vectors necessarily. Things like mattresses. There's one where they do bicycles. And that's a charitable undertaking, or there's another one where they do appliances, but it's, you know, they're just accumulating a little more slowly, and then they get driven off by the vendor to wherever they're going. So a design like that where somebody could know, that's where I always go, that's where I take my stuff, I know what they take a lot of things. And it's very easy, quick in and out, convenient. So, and it'll, by nature, be a lot cleaner because it's staffed and less likely to accumulate litter, dumping, things like that.
Going back to news sites. I've received inquiries about that from folks in the fourth. I mean, I would like to see it. I know that it's not as simple as that. Nothing is as simple as. But one of the concerns I have about this is that people, as we, the further we go without doing weekly recycling, that some folks will get discouraged about doing it. And we have a pretty highly motivated citizenry that is interested in recycling. So, you know, what I'm interested in doing is whatever we can to encourage them as they do that. So if we can identify some sites, I think it would be fabulous. And we don't know how long off we are from curbside, and we don't know how far off we are from a central facility. When you bring that up, I think, man, that sounds great. Where is that going to go? So I think it might could go right next to the new water tower down Southwest. That would be great. So, you know, it's just, sorry, Dave. So, you know, we don't know how long we're going to be here with this. And so some other sites might be a good idea if we can make that happen.
Especially if, you know, we're talking about the one off of Oakland. It's city on the property already. So I'm curious what the, we already have a sunk cost. So what are the other things? What's the expense of putting that site together would be my next question.
Well, I think your issue that you have is the contamination that happens at those sites.
Yeah.
So, I'm not saying that we shouldn't explore it, and I think ultimately if we get to the point where we can have automatic collection for recycling, I think you'll see it become a little easier for people to do it. And so I think that's the goal, but it's going to take us a while.
Yeah, I think offering as many opportunities for folks to be able to recycle between now and then is not a bad idea.
Exactly. And as we're looking at different materials to recycle and expanding that, I think that's just a benefit for our residents.
Okay. So does that answer your question, Dave, about whether you should have interested parties meeting again?
From what I just heard, I think the answer to that is yes, have the interested parties meeting again.
Okay. I think you're right.
I just heard it.
I think you're right. Hope for a different outcome.
It wasn't stated that way, but I think that's what I heard.
Yes.
And well, I just wanted to ask the question to see what your thought was after you saw this.
Good question.
Other comments, concerns, questions for Kate and Mr. Sorrell? We look forward to seeing your report.
Too easy. Yeah.
Thank you so much. If you think of something later, please feel free to send me a note. I'm happy to reply. Thank you so much for having us, and I'll see you guys again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Where's Sheila? You're very good. Hey, do you want to do closed session next, or do you want me to do the...
If you want, go ahead and get rid of that.
Okay, so before closed session, let's talk about retreat dates and the state of the court dates. So is there a preference between Tuesday, January 23rd or Tuesday, January 30th for a six-month check-in regarding our retreat? So pull out your phones, look at your calendars.
What was it again?
January 23rd or January 30th?
Would that be here or out of town?
I believe so.
Yes, in town.
In town? Okay.
In town somewhere.
Either is good for me.
What did you say, the
23rd or the 30th?
The 30th. Yeah, either works for me.
Best I know. So in the lottery.
When are we meeting? Sheila, what are our meeting dates, our regular council dates?
15th of January and then 15th
of January. The 16th? The 16th because of Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
They're both Tuesdays.
Yeah, I'd say either one.
Might as well just do an every other Tuesday.
Yeah, 30th, are we good with it? That's what I was thinking also.
30th works.
Yeah. 30th, Betsy, is that okay for you?
Yeah, it's best I know.
Right, 30th? Okay, 30th.
And then the next one is retreat dates. I think Carol sent a message, May 14th and May 15th. That would be the normal annual retreat. Any major objections to that as of right now?
And it's a Tuesday and a Wednesday.
Yep. Thank you.
What was that again?
May 14th and 15th. It's a Tuesday and a Wednesday for the normal annual retreat.
What day?
There's a particular reason why that's in the middle of the week.
Do we have ideas to why we're doing middle of the week instead of end on that one? There you go, Nick.
I'll
So it would be full day Tuesday, half day Wednesday, we keep it like normal.
If it was
thoughts?
Tentative, yes.
No immediate red flags.
I do believe that is better for you.
Red flags.
So we have the location that we visited the previous year in the open
okay.
those 2 days. And I want to
book it.
Book it?
Yeah.
If that's.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think that's fine. That's the general consensus.
I assume you checked with the mayor, right? She's
yes.
not here tonight.
She's not here. It's only okay.
All right.
I'm kidding. We need to go back to the drawing board regarding state of the court, which was initially scheduled for October 30th. Sheila will be reaching out regarding potential dates for that, so pay attention to your email.
So I'll take that off your calendars.
There you go. Okay. Any other questions or concerns on scheduling before we move to closed session? Okay. I will motion that we move to closed session in City Council in the City of Columbia, Missouri to immediately go into a closed meeting here in Conference Room 1A1B to discuss the leasing, purchase, or sale of real estate by a public governmental body where public knowledge of the transaction may adversely affect the legal consideration. Therefore, pursuant to Section 610-021, Subsection 2 of the Revised Statutes of the State of Missouri, do I have a second?
Thank you.
Roy. Mr. Canoe.
Yes.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yep, you're good. Andrew, yes. Mr. Lovelady.
Yes.
Mr. Foster.
Yes.
Mr. Waterman.
Yes.
Dr. Peters.
I think she said yes.
Where'd she go?
She's at a potato stand.
Betsy.
Yes.
Thank
you. Doesn't matter, we already got four.
Yeah.